Chapter 50. The Precious Volume. That which, when sown, bears immortal fruit, enriches mankind only when it is understood. Hence the many readings given the Scriptures, and the requisite revisions of science and health with key to the Scriptures. Mary Baker Eddy. 1908. The adjustment from Pleasant View to Chestnut Hill was not an easy one for Mrs. Eddy. One day she said to John Salcho, quote, "This is not my home. Pleasant View will always be my home." End quote. The quieter countryside was the horses' home, too. They were disturbed by the automobile traffic in Newton, and Mrs. Eddy no longer enjoyed her daily drive. What had once been a pleasant diversion became a chore. Calvin Fry found the adjustment as difficult as did Mrs. Eddy. His responsibilities and burdens were increased with the larger house and household. His every thought was to help the leader, but she also took, quote, watch care, end quote, of him, as is evident from this note she wrote Mr. Dickey when they had been at Chestnut Hill only a few weeks. Mr. Fry needs encouragement. Despondency is his belief, and the dear man has shared my deprivations many years, hoping they would cease, and so give him release as well as myself. Encourage him to find all happiness in divine love, life, spiritual, here and now. You are able to depict this, for you seem to realize it. At Pleasant View, Mrs. Eddy had started calling Adelaide Still Ada, because there had been another Adelaide in the home. At Chestnut Hill, the leader reverted to Adelaide, but many others continued calling her Ada. Miss Still was aware of how difficult the adjustment from Pleasant View to Chestnut Hill was for Mrs. Eddy, and she put forth every effort to help her. But the effort was no help to Mrs. Eddy, because it was human and not divine. Tender, loving human care was a great weight and burden upon the leader, which none seemed able to understand. And the harder Adelaide tried humanly, the more difficult it seemed to be to please Mrs. Eddy, until one day Archibald McClellan broke the mesmerism for this student. Mr. McClellan was often at Chestnut Hill on business of one kind or another, but he was not at all familiar with the household routine. As Mrs. Eddy left on her daily drive on this afternoon, Mr. McClellan turned to Miss Still, who was standing beside him, and asked what she did while Mrs. Eddy was away. Miss Still replied that she had dinner. Mr. McClellan, "How long is the drive?" Miss Still, "Not more than half an hour these days." Mr. McClellan, "That means a pretty hurried meal, doesn't it?" To this, Miss Still burst out, quote, "Oh, I wouldn't mind if I never had my dinner. If only I could do things right. If only I could please her." End quote. Mr. McClellan looked at Adelaide for a moment and then said quietly, quote, "You can, Ada, you can." End quote. In that brief moment, Ada dropped her anxious human effort, and the leader's response was immediate. By the time she returned from her drive, she expressed loving appreciation for all that Adelaide did for her. This incident marked a great step in progress for Miss Still. A short time later, the leader told her to be present when she gave instruction to the metaphysical workers. From that time, when the students were called to the leader's study for their morning lesson, Adelaide was there, though she did not stand up with them. Sometimes afterward, Mrs. Eddy would ask her, "Did you hear what I said to my students this morning?" Miss Still would respond, "Yes, Mrs. Eddy, thank you." To which the leader would reply, "That's right, dear. You always be present when I teach my students." Another student, Calvin Hill, had received helpful statements from Mrs. Eddy on several occasions because of a latent fear she detected in his thought. Once again in the spring of 1908, when he had sent her some especially fine strawberries, she said in her letter of thanks, quote, "May, oh may the love divine feed you and fill you with a strong sense of liberty, of waking from the dream of life in lungs, the infinite in the finite, and show you just how a lie destroys itself by saying, I am real." This dedicated student looked upon Mrs. Eddy as his adopted mother, and he loved her dearly, but he was one of the many who could not understand how his tender, loving, human thoughts could cause her suffering. It was probably the human thoughts of her own followers that caused her more suffering than any other one thing. The malicious intent of the wicked to destroy her life and her work was something her advanced students could understand, and they were willing workers under her direction to meet these insidious attacks. But all were misled in a varying degrees by good mortal mind, thinking because it appeared as good that it was right, and therefore spiritual. The way of spiritual reality is very straight and narrow. The leader was finding every step of this way, often through suffering, and endeavoring to teach it to the students nearest to her. She well knew that they profited most and progressed fastest from rebukes, and those in whom she had the greatest hope were rebuked more than any others. Quote, "For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth." End quote. Some of those who were rebuked went up higher, and some turned away from their leader and walked no more with her. Her rebuke to William McCracken had been indirect and comparatively mild. Nonetheless, he had turned away from the leader, separating the revelation from the revelator in his own thought. And now another dear student failed the test. Calvin Hill had devoted himself to serving Mrs. Eddy for nearly 10 years, and during this time had given up business to devote all his time to the practice of Christian Science, together with performing many services for the leader. One day when he called at Chestnut Hill, he found her suffering distressfully and breathing with great difficulty. His tender sympathy was an added burden upon her, and she rebuked him sharply, saying he must remove his thought from her. He could not see how his highest sense of human devotion could cause her to suffer. He reacted to her rebuke and left in anger, walking no more with his leader. Wounded pride and self-justification caused him to burn some of her precious letters to him, though he did so in tears, and he never saw the leader again. It was another 25 years before he was able to understand her letter to him. Beloved in Christ, Again, I have to write. Do not think of me. Your tender thought reaches me, costs me much. Leave me in God alone. He loves us both. I love all, friends and enemies. On May 1st, the leader wired a response to a request from the editor of the Daily News in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Editor, Daily News. Christian Science can and does produce universal fellowship. Miscellany, page 275. As the sequence of divine love, it explains love. It lives love. It demonstrates love. The human, material, so-called senses do not perceive this fact until they are controlled by divine love. Hence the scripture, quote, "Be still and know that I am God," end quote. Mary Baker G. Eddy. The editor wrote appreciatively to Mrs. Eddy on May 7th. "Dear Madam, permit me on behalf of the Daily News to extend to you my sincere thanks for your gracious telegraphic response to my request. Your communication was printed in our fellowship edition of last Saturday, of which it gives me pleasure to forward you two copies. Again, thanking you for your courtesy, I remain sincerely yours, John Burgess, Editor, Daily News." Whenever the leader suffered from an attack, she called upon one or another of her mental workers to work for her, for this was a very important part of their metaphysical training. If they could see, understand to some degree, and help to meet the attacks upon the leader, they were meeting the same error for themselves and for all mankind. But this advanced work was a part of the divinity course and not for the neophyte. It is important that the beginner focus upon the perfection of being and not the errors in the path. One of the errors that had been attacking the leader for years was malicious reports and rumors of her death or ill health. These reports had been sporadic for many years until 1906, when they became almost constant, worldwide, and increasingly wicked, culminating in the next friend's suit and the dedicated work of many students to meet it. Now, once again, on Saturday, the 9th of May, a New York newspaper reported that the discoverer and founder of Christian Science was seriously ill at her handsome new home and suffering so severely that she had been unable to go out for her daily drive for 2 weeks. This, of course, was picked up by all the other newspapers, and the following Tuesday, May 12th, Edwin Park from the Boston Globe went out to Chestnut Hill to see for himself. He said in the next day's Globe, "Yesterday I went to Chestnut Hill on the 12:20 p.m. train to see Mrs. Eddy take her drive, and I entered the grounds of her estate at 12:55. As I approached the house, I saw her carriage drawn up before the house. The door of the house opened, and Mrs. Eddy, walking alone and with a vigorous step, emerged from the door and approached the carriage through the porte cochere. Calvin Fry was holding the door of the carriage open, and Mrs. Sargent walked behind Mrs. Eddy with her sunshade and some light wraps. I stopped 100 feet from the carriage, and as Mrs. Eddy stepped out from the house, she stopped and looked around at the flowers and budding trees. I came within her range of vision, and she bowed and smiled. Mr. Dickey went over to Mr. Park, and as the carriage drove past, Mrs. Eddy leaned forward and gave him another bow and smile. He was invited indoors and entertained by Mr. Dickey, Mrs. Sargent, and Reverend Irving Tomlinson, who told him that Mrs. Eddy had missed her drive only twice since moving to Chestnut Hill, both times in consideration for the horses in heavy freezing weather. They also denied seriatim the other statements in the false report stating that no inquiry had been made at the house. They, of course, did not know whether the leader would see him upon her return, but she did call him up to her study for a brief but gracious greeting. He wrote in his article, "The writer certifies that she is apparently stronger physically and quite as alert mentally as she was 11 months ago when I visited with her for 40 minutes on the afternoon of June 15th at Pleasant View. If there has been any change in Mrs. Eddy's physical condition during the past 11 months, it has been for the better." As Mrs. Sargent and I entered the commodious room, Mrs. Eddy rose from her chair and quickly, taking the 3 or 4 steps which covered the distance between her chair and the end of the desk, advanced to meet me with right hand outstretched in greeting. She looked me straight in the eyes, and as she took and shook my hand with a strong grasp, she said, quote, "Mr. Park, I am very glad to see you again," end quote. It was then that I remarked that she was looking wonderfully well and asked her if she were well, and she replied, quote, "Why, of course," end quote. Still holding my hand, Mrs. Eddy again said, quote, "I am glad you called. I would ask you to sit down, but this is my time for work. It is a work of eternity. The hours do not give me time enough," end quote. Following Mr. Park's visit, the leader sent 2 notices for publication in the next Sentinel. The first, a word of advice, quote, "To whom it may concern," end quote, Miscellany, page 276, that they, quote, "be composed and resigned to the shocking fact that she, Mrs. Eddy, is minding her own business and recommends this surprising privilege to all her dear friends and enemies," end quote. The second, quote, "Nota bene," end quote, Miscellany, page 139, because of, quote, "the recent rumors," end quote, was reassurance for her students at that time and for all time. "Rest assured that your leader is living, loving, acting, enjoying. She is neither dead nor plucked up by the roots, but she is keenly alive to the reality of living." The day before these notices were published, Mrs. Eddy dictated to Mr. Dickey 1 more statement regarding this recent rumor, a letter to the New York Herald, Miscellany, page 275. This letter of May 15th brought the following response of May 18th from the Committee on Publication in New York City, Mr. John V. Dittemore. "Dear Mrs. Eddy, your splendid letter to the editor of the New York Herald was published yesterday. I enclose clipping in order that you may see by the prominence they gave it, how highly it was appreciated. The broad-minded charity, love, and tolerance you have expressed will add to the rapidly increasing recognition by the whole world of its debt to you. In my talk with you last week, you said, quote, "Everything must come out right when we trust in God," end quote. This statement has been with me constantly, and a realization in some small measure of what you know it means has brought me a clearer understanding of what the omnipotence of God and of His present availability than I have ever before known. I shall not try to express in words my gratitude to you, but rather may my, quote, "works," end quote, bear witness. I hope I shall never be, quote, "found wanting," end quote, when any opportunity arises for serving you and our beloved cause. Most sincerely, J. V. Dittamore. The spring and summer of 1908 were marked by unusually severe thunderstorms in Newton. For many years, Mrs. Eddy had taught the students in her household that they were not Christian Scientists until they handled the weather. In one of her lessons at Chestnut Hill, she said, "Mesmerists claim they can do what they want to the weather, as they claim they can do as they will with sickness. You all know you can control a headache or a belief of dyspepsia, and you are not afraid of it. Sickness is a belief of mortal mind. Now, what is a storm? Is it not a false claim of material law? Is there any such thing as material law? Then, if bad weather or lightning is an erroneous concept of mortal law, can't you break it up?" End quote. Now, I want you to prepare yourselves to do this. I remember once when we were having a terrific storm, and the lightning was around the house like chains. The students were with me, and I declared to them that there was no surplus electricity, and in a few minutes the whole storm disappeared. Now you know there are no thunderstorms in divine mind, no lightning in heaven. So prepare to break up these violent storms. There is no need for them. Adam Dickey recorded that after all the workers had repaired to their several rooms to work, following the leader's instructions regarding the weather, the bells started ringing, calling them all back to her study. After they had lined up in front of the teacher, she pointed her finger at the first student and said, "Mr. Dickey, can a Christian Scientist control the weather?" "Yes, Mother," he responded. She put the same question to each, with the same answer. Then, with a look of scorn, she said emphatically, much to everyone's surprise, "They can't, and they don't." Then she explained to them, "They can't, but God can and does." Now, I want you to see the point I am making. A Christian Scientist has no business attempting to control or govern the weather, any more than he has a right to attempt to control or govern sickness. But he does know and must know that God governs the weather, and no other influence can be brought to bear upon it. When we destroy mortal mind's belief that it is a creator, and that it produces all sorts of weather, good as well as bad, we shall then realize God's perfect weather, and be the recipients of His bounty in that respect. God's weather is always right. A certain amount of rain and sunshine is natural and normal, and we have no right to interfere with the stately operations of divine wisdom in regulating meteorological conditions. Now, I called you back because I felt you did not get my former instructions correctly, and I want you to remember that the weather belongs to God. And when we destroy the operations of mortal mind and leave the question of regulating the weather to God, we shall have weather conditions as they should be. A letter was published in the Sentinel of May 30th, which Mrs. Eddy had received a week or two earlier from a student in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Dear Leader, in the first edition of your remarkable book, Science and Health, we read, quote, "Life is the forming and governing principle of all things." This statement makes plain the meaning of Jesus' words, quote, "I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly," end quote. With grateful heart, I thank you for the spiritual help received through obtaining and reading from time to time the new revisions of this, our textbook, which so illumines the Bible, thus leading thought to clearer views of God's universe of spirit, mind. As I have gained some realizing sense of the great amount of work you have put into Science and Health, the price paid for each book seems a very meager return for your loving labor. Faithful Leader, no words can better express your love for all mankind. It seems to me, then, those given in the striking tribute you have paid to the memory of your earthly mother and chiseled on stone in the pretty, quote, Park Cemetery, end quote, at Tilton, New Hampshire, her life the grand realities impart that fix their records deeply in the heart. Lovingly yours, Lewis Prescott. Did this letter cause the Leader to think about that precious first edition and the many revisions she had followed in the ensuing 33 years? She says of this stupendous work, quote, "I have revised Science and Health only to give a clearer and fuller expression of its original meaning. That which one sown bears immortal fruit, enriches mankind only when it is understood. Hence, the requisite revisions of Science and Health with key to the Scriptures," end quote. Science and Health, page 361. In retrospection and introspection, she calls the first edition the precious volume, quote, "containing the complete statement of Christian Science," end quote. A comparative study of the changes and additions is enlightening and rewarding, and a study the Leader recommended in the much-publicized review of the 50th edition of Science and Health, which stated in part, "A practical suggestion or two regarding study of the new edition. In the first place, do not attempt to dispose of the earlier editions. Fortunate is he who has all former revisions, together with the original edition of 1875. Keep them all. They will prove a, quote, treasure trove," end quote. Let the new volume be studied in connection with earlier editions. Of course, the latest edition is necessary for the weekly lessons in the Christian Science Quarterly. But the lesson is only the beginning of the student's study. Perhaps Mrs. Eddy began thinking once more of encouraging the student to comparative study of the revisions of their textbook. Miscellaneous writings had seen many editions in the 11 years since it was first published. At least 79 editions, and perhaps more, had been published when, in 1908, she added footnotes on several pages. All of these footnotes refer the reader to earlier editions of Science and Health. Some of the footnotes have been changed since 1910. But this listing is as Mrs. Eddy left them. Page 35. See editions prior to that of January 1886. Page 83. See the revised edition of 1886. Page 309. See the revised edition of 1890. Page 379. See Science and Health, page 47, revised edition of 1890. Page 401. Page 292 of the revised edition of 1890. Page 415. Page 234, revised edition of 1890. The major editions prior to 1886 were the first edition, 1875, the third edition, 1881, and the sixth edition, 1883. The revised edition of 1886 was the 16th edition, and that of 1890 was the 50th edition. Not one of these editions was available in the reading rooms in 1908, when Mrs. Eddy had these six footnotes added to miscellaneous writings. What could her purpose have been other than to turn the student to a comparative study of earlier editions of the textbook? The portrait and caption on page 459 also appeared in the 1908 edition of Miscellaneous Writings. This picture was one of several of Mrs. Eddy taken about 1886. Another in the series was used as a frontispiece for Science and Health in some of the early editions about that time. This picture was the frontispiece in Miscellaneous Writings from its first edition, copyrighted in 1896, and first off the press early in 1897. And this portrait of Mrs. Eddy continued as the frontispiece in Miscellaneous Writings as long as the leader was here. However, no artist or photographer was able to portray Mrs. Eddy as she was, for their thought was so far from where hers was. So she was never satisfied with their pictures. It is recorded in Collectanea that she once commented about the picture in Miscellaneous Writings, quote, "It is too confoundedly pleasant," end quote. Her sweetness was heavenly serious.